Right, so we're starting with Ecclesiastes chapter 4, which is on page 670. And then if you'd like to move forward a little and put your finger in Isaiah 65, which you'll find on 752. But I'll remind you when I come to it. Right, Ecclesiastes chapter 4. Again I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter. And I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun. And I saw that all labour and all achievement spring from man's envy of his neighbour. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. The fool folds his hands and ruins himself. Better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. Again I saw something meaningless under the sun. There was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. For whom am I toiling, he asked, and why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless, a miserable business. Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can help him up. But pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. Better a poor but wise youth than an old but foolish king who no longer knows how to take warning. The youth may have come from prison to the kingship, or he may have been born in poverty within his kingdom. I saw that all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth, the king's successor. There was no end to all the people who were before them. But those who came later were not pleased with the successor. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. And now we turn to Isaiah 65 on page 752. And we start at verse 17. And it's a little different aspect than we've just read in Ecclesiastes. Behold, I will create new heavens and a new earth. The former things will not be remembered, nor will they come to mind, but be glad and rejoice forever in what I will create. For I will create Jerusalem to be a delight and its people a joy. I will rejoice over Jerusalem and take delight in my people. The sound of weeping and of crying will be heard in it no more. Never again will there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his years. He who dies at 100 will be thought a mere youth. He who fails to reach 100 will be considered accursed. They will build houses and dwell in them. They will plant vineyards and eat their fruit. No longer will they build houses and others live in them, or plant and others eat. For as the days of a tree, so will be the days of my people. My chosen ones will long enjoy the works of their hands. They will not toil in vain, or bear children doomed to misfortune. For they will be a people blessed by the Lord, they and their descendants with them. Before they call, I will answer. While they are still speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb will feed together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. But dust will be the serpent's food. Neither will they harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, says the Lord.
Coral said two very different pictures, very different images. One, if you like, a vision of how one day God will make things. The other, if you like, a picture of how things are. How things are today. We're going to focus on Ecclesiastes 4 to an extent. But I just wanted to read that other reading so it was there in the back of your mind. And those images and those pictures act as the contrast to what we're coming across in Ecclesiastes chapter 4. But reading this passage, I was reminded of an old Peanuts comic strip. You remember Peanuts, the comic strip, with the conversation that takes place between Sally and Charlie Brown. Sally, who's Charlie Brown's little sister, says, "Wake up, big brother. Wake up, wake up. What are you waking me up for? I thought you might like to get an early start." "For what? I'm not going anywhere." "That's too bad. You could have been the first one there." Apparently, and maybe Hazel has come across this, in one of the African languages, the noun used for a non-African white person is a person who rushes around to no apparent purpose. Have you come across that one? Not come across that one. I don't know where it's from. It's just something I read, but that's kind of amusing. In a sense, that's kind of amusing, or would be if it wasn't for this insane desire to be the first one there. That desire, which is so common and actually I think so destructive, both in Koheleth's day. Koheleth, for those of you who haven't been here, is the name for the narrator of this book that we're reading. He's an observer of life. He's a poet, a philosopher, a prophet maybe. I suspect maybe even a pastor. Or the ancient equivalent of a pastor, let's say. That desire to be the first one there. That desire to be top of the pile. So look at verse 1. Look at verse 1. "Again I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun." That's here, that's on the earth, that's in life, that's his observation of the way things are. "I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of the oppressors, and they have no comforter." 2,000, 2,500, whenever, we're not 100% sure when this book was written, Koheleth looked round and he saw injustice, inequality, oppression. And one has to say, 2,000 years later, it's not an awful lot different, is it? Not an awful lot different. In the Bible, oppression involves cheating one's neighbour out of something, defrauding him, robbing him. It involves making an unjust gain. So, for example, in the Old Testament law, it would include profit made from the interest of loans. It is the abuse of power. Financial power, other sorts of power, perpetrated by those who are powerful on those who are vulnerable. And particularly in Old Testament times, that's signified by terms like the poor, the widow, orphan, foreigners, those who are vulnerable, those who have no means to support themselves, as it were. Oppression in Old Testament terms is accumulation. It's seeking after profit without worrying how you got that profit, without worrying about the needs and the rights of the wider community. Oppression in the Old Testament is where power and wealth become more and more focused in a small section of the community. If you like, it's when the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And it's fascinating reading the Old Testament law, some of the mechanisms that are there, if you like, to try and prevent that happening, to try and stop that happening. It's when, if you like, the richest 1% in society own more than the poorest 50%, and the gap is growing. Actually, according to the latest stats I saw for Britain, that figure's 55%. 55% of the wealth, 55% of the wealth belongs with the richest 1% in society. Maybe it's when there are serious financial provision in the social care provision for the eldest, because suddenly we're paying those who care for them a living wage. A wage that's still way below the national average. I wonder what that says about who we value as a society when those who care for the most vulnerable members of society are paid so poorly. I wonder what that says. I wonder what the Old Testament prophets, I wonder what Koheleth would say about that. It's where, well, you get the picture. Ultimately, it's when the most vulnerable members of society are marginalised and ignored. And those things grieve Koheleth's heart, and I believe those things grieve God's heart as well. And maybe that sounds a bit political to you. In a sense, yes, it is. Because politics is primarily about how we organise ourselves as a society, both locally but also nationally and internationally. And God is very interested in politics, because God has pretty strong views about how society should be organised. And especially about how those who are most vulnerable, those who are at the bottom of the pile, are treated. I'm not sure he's particularly interested in party politics. I suspect not. But when people are oppressed, he most certainly is interested. When community breaks down, then God is most certainly interested. Remember what Mary says of him in her song. He has brought down rulers from their thrones, but has lifted up the humble. He has filled the hungry with good things, but he has sent the rich away empty. I wonder what that means if we really took those words seriously, that this is what God is like, that this is what God is concerned about, that this is how God's care is expressed. Again, I looked, Koheleth says, and I saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of the oppressors, and they have no comforter. Twice, did you notice, twice in those verses, Koheleth reports that the oppressed have no comforter. I guess what he's hinting at is, first and foremost, that's what they need. A comforter. Someone to come alongside them. Someone to hear their cries. Someone who is on their side. Someone who will work with them to change the situation. I'm not sure our word comfort carries all of those senses, but the Hebrew word and the Greek words do. It's more than just sort of saying they're there to someone. It is that. But there's something about actively trying to change the situation, the circumstances of the one who needs comfort. And of course, who's number one comforter? Who's the number one comforter? Paul says this: praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort. The God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our troubles, so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves received from God. The God of all comfort. That's a wonderful term, isn't it? Wonderful term, wonderful phrase. Who comforts us so that we can be agents, if you like, of his comforting. God comforts us in our troubles, and God gives us a ministry of comfort. A ministry of bringing comfort. He calls on us to hear the cry of the poor, the marginalised, the despised, the shut out, the victims, the hurting, the broken, the excluded. To hear the cry and to reach out with the love of Christ. That's part of our mission, part of our ministry as God's people. To comfort the oppressed, the poor, the weak, the vulnerable. Do you remember that question that Cain asked God after he killed his brother Abel? One of the first things that happens after the fall. In Genesis you get this picture of, I guess, peace, harmony, shalom. And then Adam and Eve sin, and suddenly they're at each other's throats. It's his fault, it's her fault. It was him, it was the snake. Blaming everybody and anything. And then chapter later, we find Cain killing his brother Abel and then saying to God, am I my brother's keeper? Am I my sister's keeper? And the witness of the law and the prophets and Jesus and Paul and Koheleth is yes. Yes, you are your brother's keeper. Yes, you are your sister's keeper. Especially when they're weak and vulnerable and oppressed. There's a remarkable story in the paper a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if anyone else saw it. It was about a congregation of a church in Tottenham called Highway House. I must confess I'd not heard of that church before. But they took a decision 7 years ago that they were going to offer their building as a shelter to 50 destitute men. Most of them addicted to drugs or alcohol or suffering mental health problems. They were people that were falling through the net. They were people that social services had tried but had not succeeded with. And the congregation, many of whom were on low incomes themselves, agreed that each of them would donate between 10 and 20% of their income to this project. Fairly small church, they raised £80,000 a year just for this project. And during the week they gave over their church premises to this project. It was interesting, this project came to the public attention because of a report, analysing the success of such projects and what they contribute towards society. This project was deemed a good project because of every £1 that was invested, they reckon that the project saved £8 in what the government would otherwise have spent on supporting these people. It's a good investment. You spend £1 and you get eight pound back. The church emphasizes the fruit of transformed lives and how these men's lives, many of them, are being transformed and turned around, and marriages put back together, and kids being reconnected with their parents, and men finding faith. I was just fascinated to see the difference. The economists, if you like, the politicians celebrate that this is a good project because it saves money. The church celebrates that this is a good project because lives are transformed and broken lives are put back together again. And both are good. Both are good. But that church is being a comforter. Comforting the weak, the vulnerable. Transforming lives. Comfort. comforting those at the bottom sometimes means getting alongside them, oftentimes. Getting alongside, getting your hands dirty, helping. But I think it also means challenging those with power. Challenging those who make decisions about spending priorities. How as a society we spend our money. What's important for us to spend our money on. Challenging those who shape how our society is structured. I know I haven't been very good at that in the past and I need to do better. Challenging and praying. We've got a new Prime Minister in case you hadn't noticed. It's been a weird few weeks, hasn't it? A weird few weeks. Pray for Theresa May as she takes up her new role as Prime Minister. Many of you will have heard her first speech this week as Prime Minister. She said some really interesting things about fighting injustice, about improving services for those with mental health problems, and boy, do they need improving. About being driven by the interests of those for whom life is a struggle. Of tackling the cycle where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And it's easy when you hear that to be either naive or cynical. We've heard those words before. But perhaps those words were simply the words of a vicar's daughter who had in her mind an echo of Mary's song. I don't want to prejudge Theresa May, but at the same time, I want to hold her to account. It's a wonderful vision she paints. I want to check that she delivers. And I think as Christians, that's part of our ministry as well. To ask our society, how do we care for the vulnerable? How do we care for the weak? How do we care for those at the bottom? And I say, it's not party political. How do we care for those who have a special place in God's heart? But there's another dimension here, I think, to Kohelet's message. Look, touched upon it earlier in the service. And that is that what oppression does is that it spoils community. It destroys community. And without community, everyone suffers. All this toil, he says, springs from one person's envy of another. A community divided against itself, of that insane appetite to be first, to be top of the pile. And then look at verse 8. There was a man all alone, he said. And we know from Genesis 2 that it's not good. Do you remember that? It's not good for a man to be alone. There were no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. He wanted more and more and more and more. Greed and envy and selfishness and pride separate us from each other and destroy community. And that grieves God's heart. And that grieves God's heart. It's not just because Hazel's here, but I want to go back to Africa again, and to an African concept called Ubuntu. I don't know if you've heard of it. Anyone heard of Ubuntu? I knew you'd say that, yeah. It's a computer operating system. It's the idea that as human beings that we can't exist in isolation from other human beings. It's about our interconnectedness as people. Someone once said, you can't be a human all on your own. You can't be a human all on your own. Archbishop Desmond Tutu said like this. He said, we say a person is a person through other persons. We don't come fully formed into the world. We learn how to think, how to walk, how to speak, how to behave, indeed how to be human from other people. We need other human beings in order to be human. We're made for togetherness. We're made for family, for fellowship. To exist in a network of interdependence. And he talks about why apartheid is so evil, because it seeks to separate, to spread enmity and alienation and apartness. What he's saying is our health, our well-being is interconnected. It's like what Paul says when he's talking about the body, the church. If one part suffers, every part suffers with it. If one part is honoured, every part rejoices with it. In a sense, we're bound together. We're bound together, and when one of us hurts, we all share in some way that pain. And when community breaks down or becomes fractured, we all suffer. Paul's talking about the church, but I think those words, in a sense, apply as well to the wider society. And it's interesting, though, when you look at the Bible, when you read the Bible from beginning to end, what you see happening is God forming a community. In the Old Testament, it's Israel. And it's the history of this people that he has called together and rescued and delivered and set apart to be God's people, to live together, to flourish together, to worship God together, to learn, to grow together, to together learn what it means to be God's people. And in the New Testament, it's the church. It's the church. A people who will together witness to the transforming power of God's love. Life-giving, life-celebrating communities where there are no first and second class citizens. Where nobody is told they failed to reach the expected standard. Where each individual is recognised and celebrated as a child of God. And discovers the joy and freedom of that. Of being God's precious son, God's precious daughter. Matthew 5, Jesus says this. He says, if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them, and then come and offer your gift. Somehow our relationship with God is tied up with our relationship with other people. Our faith has a horizontal, if you like, and a vertical dimension. God's not up there, but you know what I mean. Up and along. Being in a right relationship with God and being in good and healthy relationships with each other go together. God has called, God continues to call a people to love him, to worship him, to serve him, and to demonstrate in their life together something of what God's rule looks like, something of what God's reign looks like. Two really is better than one. Three is even better, even if that cord did get broken. I must use stronger string next time. Remember Jesus' words, though. Where two or three gather in my name, there I am with them. Not one, but where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am with them. And I believe that in a sense, God's answer to the oppression and the division that we see around us is found in the church. Not as a cop-out, not as somewhere where we can go to escape the world, but a place of transformation, of genuine community, genuine caring, genuine love, genuine mutual support, genuine openness to all who come through our doors, genuine reaching out to those who maybe would never darken our doors but desperately need comfort. In Acts 2, you have this multicolour experience, really, with wind and with flames and with strange languages, and then you get this incredibly powerful sermon from Peter, and then mass conversion. And then at the end of that chapter, all the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Each day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. I think four times in those verses, together. They did this together. They did that together. They shared lives together. I think that's a picture of what happens when the Spirit is at work in the world, in the church, breaking down barriers, breaking down oppression, breaking down the brokenness, the individualism, the sin that separates us from one another. We are one body, Paul tells us, because we share one loaf. So we come to the table, to our community feast, to the meal that binds us together and which reminds us that our unity comes from one place, from the love of God, from the fact that we're all sinners saved by grace and called to be part of his family, part of his new society, part of this thing that we call church. Reminder that we who receive the comfort of God are called to be comforters of others. It is not good for a person to be alone. We are our brothers and sisters' keepers. Two are better than one. And a cord of three strands is not easily broken. Thanks be to God. Amen.